Welcome to the Natural Selection Presents Red. Welcome back, listeners, to a new episode of the Natural Selection Presents. This week we are back to talk about Red. But first, we were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have Nick.
Hello.
We have Naomi.
Hello.
And we have other Nick. Hi. Because that's me. So I suppose we should tell the listeners who we are. Nick, do you want to give that a whirl?
I can. I'd love to. We are the Natural Selection. We're a group of taxonomists who enter your earbuds every week to bring you our passion for nature from the wild. Every week we gather and talk about the natural world and the crazy things in it. In the first section of our wonderful podcast, we talk about nature news and interesting research from the past week. In the second section of our podcast, we talk about a different theme each week and how it relates to flora and fauna around the world. This week's theme is red.
So how have you guys been? Have you bumped into any animals or plants recently? I sure did, because I went to the zoo.
Oh, amazing. Which one did you go to?
The one in the east, which is Tiergarten, I think. Is that correct?
One?
It was big. I was tired.
Yeah, that's how you should feel after a zoo.
Yeah, it was a long old walk with lots of animals. It felt big enough for the animals. There was space. Yeah, it was really lovely. I had a little staycation. I had a week off work and nowhere really to go in Corona times. So I had a little staycation in Berlin, did all the touristy things, and that included going to a zoo. I saw some amazing animals, including ones which weren't in the cages, which were things like dragonflies, which were fun. But I saw a red panda. That was a particular highlight. Some scary looking tigers. One of the tigers just stared me down.
I know the exact tiger that you're talking about. Because I also felt as if, one, it could leap over the small gap between it.
Oh my God, yes!
And two, that it wanted me. Like, I yes! have also wanted ever.
As it stared at me, because I went over really relaxed because it's a zoo and I assume they're professional and know what they're doing. But as it stared at me, more and more I could think was like, that's not that big a gap.
It's not.
I like, if he really, really wanted it, he could have that.
Yeah. And then it's curtains.
Yeah.
For the Knicks. Naomi, you'll have to carry on the podcast in our memory alone.
Oh, I thought of you when there was a herd of Tibetan horses.
Oh, cool. Oh, those, yeah. The horses are so cool there. Those are the ones that are like sand colored.
Yeah.
Cool. Alas, I didn't see anything cool like the zoo, Nick, but I did see an animal in my cage. Let me clarify. I was cooking in my kitchen the other day with the window open and a wood pigeon came in.
Oh.
It flew right in and started pecking at the windowsill. It was like, hello. Stayed for a while.
Oh, wow. Did it just go out easily on its own, or did you have to, like, chew it out?
It was just, it didn't come in farther than the windowsill, but it was, like, on the inside of the, it was, like, inside of the windowsill. It was not, it was, like, a presence in the room. It wasn't just, like, oh, look at the bird outside. It was, like, hello, there's a bird in here. It didn't poop on anything, luckily. I think it was having some sort of, like, good guest mentality, but, you know, it flew away after a while onto the chimney of the house across from me, so I could watch it, but.
What were you cooking?
Spaghetti. Which is, I think, why I left.
What about you, Naomi? Anything that beats a zoo or a pigeon in a kitchen?
I don't think I can beat a pigeon in a kitchen. I did see quite a few insects this week. And now I'm not very good at identifying insects. And what I saw, I think it was a damselfly, could have been a dragonfly, but you know how fast they fly? I like saw it was like a blue blur and then it was gone. So I was trying to look up different species of dragonfly that are found in the UK. And there's a lot of blue ones. Some of them called blue, like common blue, blue tailed. So I don't know what species, but my guess is a damselfly.
I also had a rather lovely damselfly slash dragonfly experience. I went to the lake, which is also a done thing on touristy days in Berlin. And I went swimming on said lake, which was beautiful and clear. But at eye level, as I swam out into the middle of the lake, all of the dragonflies were flying about like at eye level from where I was swimming. And all of a sudden, I was like just amongst all these dragonflies, which was really beautiful. And they were blue as well. So I wonder if they're all coming out over Europe.
Regardless of what species it was, it definitely had structural color. You who listen to our blue episode will know what we're talking about.
I told my friend that at the lake. And even better, when I relayed this story, we were Skyping with my family and they were like, have you been boring her with science? And I was like, well, I did tell her a dragonfly fact at the lake, and she went, it wasn't just one fact.
You spend every week preparing for a 45-minute podcast, you're bound to have some facts stuck in there. They need to get out.
They do. And speaking of, I believe we all have facts we need to get out right now.
Yeah.
And I certainly have one about migrating birds. So while we're all stuck still during Corona times, there are still species that are flying around the world. And the biodiversity department at Lund University in Sweden, funded by Acker Lindstrom, I believe, was looking at snipes. And they were looking at the migratory patterns of snipes. Because what they realized recently is that actually the altitude of migrating birds varies a lot more than they previously thought. So they were looking into this. And one interesting thing that they found was that great snipes follow a diel. Is that right? Diel? D-I-E-L?
Yeah.
Great snipes follow a diel altitude cycle. So they fly much higher in the day than they do at night, even though they're flying at both day and night. In fact, they found at dawn, they would rise to perhaps up to 2,000 meters. So they were really, really, really reacting to daylight in their flight patterns, which is quite amazing. Most birds at some point would reach over 6,000 meters. Nick, you'll have to help me there. That's about 18,000 feet.
You're totally right. Yes, 18,000.
18,000 feet. So incredibly high birds. So it's not really understood why the migrating birds vary their height so much. So this was sort of looking into why that might be happening. So they were thinking maybe it's to do with orientation. Another theory, this one sort of immediately jumped out at me, was predator avoidance. The higher they go, probably be harder for bigger birds to follow them up there. So they're avoiding their predators. And the other one they suggested was the need for cooling. Because as you go higher, if you're flying in direct sun, it could be incredibly hot. But as you go higher, the temperature drops. And if you're exerting a lot of energy, this might actually be quite useful in the long run if you need to cool down in the hot sun. And would explain also why they drop back down in the nighttime. But they go on to suggest that, yeah, basically repeated flight altitude changes could be a common phenomenon amongst migrating birds. So quite interesting. And one real good takeaway from this is that one bird was recorded at a height of 8,700 meters. And it was at this time for about 5 minutes. And this may be the highest recorded flight of a migrating bird. And to give you an idea of how tall that is, Everest is 8,849. So it's only 150 meters shy of hitting Everest, which is pretty impressive.
They could definitely go. They could make it. No problem.
Yeah. If they really wanted it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's a little insight into the great snipes and them flying over Africa. Nick, I believe you wanted to take us back to the ground.
Yeah, but I still want to talk about migrations loosely. The research that I found this week, it's sort of a roundabout way of getting to the headline, but basically looking at ecological corridors through the desert regions of North Africa at the time when early humans might have been leaving Africa and dispersing throughout Eurasia. Researchers on human evolution have long been interested in early dispersal of humans out of Africa, and the two competing theories that have been sort of fighting each other in recent times have been one, that it was the unique behavioral capacities of early modern humans that let them travel through the desert. So they could essentially like pack and travel in this sort of early modern humans. The other is that actually there were climatic changes that shifted this desert environment to something a bit more lush that let people sort of move through in bursts, like bridges through the desert at different times. And this research that was published in PNAS by a team of international researchers this week gives another piece for the evidence for the latter theory, but from a strange source. So this study was looking at an unusual fossil assemblage found in a cave in the Judean desert in Israel, which dated to about 40,000 to 100,000 years ago. And almost all of the fossils that were found in that cave were specimens from a species known as Lophiomys imhousii maremortum, which is a subspecies of the African crested rat, which you might think is odd to find the African crested rat in Israel, far from its homeland, which is in East Africa today. But it turns out that the subspecies may have been able to move across the Saharan Desert during a time when it was not so dry, just at the same time that early humans may have moved across the Saharan Desert. So it seems to give evidence that there was some ability for these creatures that need vegetation, water, and undergrowth and food to move through in some sort of ecological corridor from East Africa into the sort of Levant, the Near East area, which I think is a super cool sort of by proxy way of getting a better sense of how humans have evolved and moved around. But then also, of course, we know a little bit more about rats, which, don't get me started on these crested rats. They're pretty cool. Just a brief aside, they have venomous spines, and they also have plated head armor. They're one of the few mammal species that have it. Anyway, so that's that on the crested rat. But it gives us on human evolution.
Cool. I love the rhymed ending. So I hope, Naomi, you've got a few minutes to think of how to end yours on a rhyme. So no pressure. I think you wanted to talk to us perhaps the most fabulous of all the animals today.
Potentially, yes. Well, we'll see. We'll see if any more fabulous animals come up when we are talking about the color red. But my piece of research came from the paper Science, and it was led by a researcher from the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior, working with other researchers from Germany and also Australia. So it was looking at cockatoos, and it was looking at how they learn. So they observed a few years ago, the lead researcher found a video of a cockatoo opening a bin with its beak and its foot and getting inside the bin. And they decided, because bins across Australia have relatively conserved opening mechanisms, they were wondering, you know, is this a behavior you'll see in lots of birds and all birds? Is this something that's common among cockatoos? Like, how do they learn about this? So they did a survey asking people if they've seen this behavior. So in 2018, they launched this survey across Sydney and on other parts of Australia. And then they asked people if they'd seen this behavior before. So at the end of this, they got the survey back and they found that residents from 44 areas have observed this bin opening behavior, and that they showed that this trait seems to spread pretty quickly and quite widely. And also they seem to show that the behavior reached neighboring districts before it reached districts that were further away. So it seems like it wasn't just randomly popping up, like it was kind of spreading. So they suggest that the animals are learning the behavior from other cockatoos in the vicinity. And on top of this, there's also different cockatoos seem to have different ways of opening the bin. So in different areas, there seems to be like almost like a little subculture of how to open the bin. And it's a behavior that maybe only about 10% of these birds can do, but it seems to be kind of what they're calling the pioneers. So other cockatoos will wait for that bird to open the bin, and then they'll eat the leftovers. So yeah, they also marked individual birds as well with little paint dots so that they could observe their individual behavior. And that's how they discovered this, with the percentage of the birds. It appeared to be mostly males, and only about 10% of them seem to do it. But this is really cool. It shows that it's a learned social behavior that these birds seem to be able to do, which is quite cool. It's not something that's hugely found or studied in animals outside of humans or other primates. So that's my news on some clever cockatoos.
Oh. Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, that was pretty good. That does bring us to the end of the news. But we do hope you choose to stay on to listen to our next section, where we'll be talking about our theme, which this week is red. Welcome back, listeners, to part two of our podcast, where we will talk about our theme, red. Now, every now and again, we get a little treat where we are surprised with a quiz. And I believe this week, Naomi is acting quiz master.
So when I was researching for this week, I was trying to look for some cool red animals. And while I was searching, I realized that a lot of red animals have some really interesting names. So I want to give you guys a quiz. So I will tell you the name of this animal, and I'd like you to tell me what type of animal it is. Okay.
Okay.
So, first one, velvet ant.
Ooh.
She looks mischievous, so I'm going to say ant.
I think it's a wasp.
Yes, it is a wasp. The wingless females resemble hairy ants. They have an extremely painful sting, and their common name is called cow killer or cow ant. And they're solitary, and they don't really have a very complex social system. And they're like a bright red color. Or they sometimes, some of the species can be orange, but some of them are like a bright red.
We obviously have them in Arizona because we have everything dangerous and poisonous and painful in Arizona.
And cows.
And we have cows. Yeah, the cows they kill.
Okay, next one. Red eft.
That sounds like you're trying to describe in how much trouble you're in. It's like, we are red effed.
Is it a bird?
Do you know what? Everything with a silly name, I always feel like is a bird or a fish. So I'll go with fish.
So it's actually the juvenile stage of an eastern newt or a red spotted newt. It produces tetrodotoxin. So it prevents it from getting eaten by predators. The fulvous forest skimmer.
I feel like that's a bird.
I'm going to say gliding squirrel.
It's a dragonfly.
Ah.
It's quite lovely, actually. So, again, this one is kind of like a rusty brown color. But I think that's what fulvous means. I struggle to say that word, but I think it means like the kind of tawny, reddy brown.
It is quite beautiful.
Yes, yeah, it's a good one. So next one, now I'm kind of cheating a little bit here because technically there's several species that could be called this, but I'm thinking about one specific one. But if you get close, I'll give it to you. So red spider.
So obviously you can't say spider. I'm going to say mite.
Yeah, I was going to say mite, but I'm going to go with a different one. Is one of them a crab?
So it was actually a mite is what I was looking for. Yeah, red spider mite. Now, although I do believe there are actually species of spider that are called red spider, but there seems to be quite a few species of red spider mites that are called red spiders. So,
in fact, the one that infected Spider-Man was red, so they're quite common.
Okay, hairy squat lobster.
Bird.
I'm going to go crayfish.
It's a squat lobster. Yeah, it's a lobster. So it's
I knew you'd do that once. I knew you'd do it.
So it's closely related to like hermit crabs. So it's that group that's trying to be a crab but are not crabs. So it's close to that. So next one is red lory.
Yellow lory.
Bird.
Yeah, that's a bird, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a parrot. Final one. And then I have one bonus question. So final one is blood red glider.
That's the squirrel.
Oh. That wasn't my instinct, but you said it so confidently that, blood red glider. Is that a snake?
It's a butterfly.
Ah!
Okay, and a bonus point, or to win the quiz, I cheated and I named one animal that wasn't red. Do you know what it was?
Can you please list all of them again?
So there was a velvet ant, the red eft, the fulvous forest skimmer, the red spider mite, the hairy squat lobster, the red lorry, and the blood red glider.
I forfeit my guess because I was looking them up after you announced what kind of animal it was, see what they looked like.
Okay, so for all the beans, I feel like this is based on no biological thing, but a psychological analysis of Naomi. I'm going to go with the red eft, simply because it's got the word red in it, and also it might mature into a red animal.
No, it's not that one. It's the hairy squat lobster. It's pink.
Ah,
pink though.
There is very funky. I'm surprised you didn't call me out for it, Nick, when you were looking them up.
I did actually, but I got lost in the. I tried to.
That's that, Naomi. Now, when our theme was red, there was one thing that jumped immediately to my mind, which is something that I know we will have all worked with, IUCN Red List. So, for the listeners out there who may not have heard of this, the IUCN is the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. So, very, very fancy sounding thing. Some 16,000 scientists participate in their work on a voluntary basis, and there's about 1,000 full-time staff in more than 50 countries, but it's based in Switzerland. But the Red List was founded in 1964, and it was originally to look at threatened plants. It's grown today to be the world's most comprehensive inventory of the global conservation status of biological species. So that sounds very, very fancy. But what that means is in the news, you will often hear this species is endangered, or this species is critically endangered. So who is deciding this? Well, it's factors created by the IUCN Red List. But yeah, so it uses a set of criteria to evaluate the extinction risk of thousands of species and subspecies. What this does is it generally is for a worldwide thing, but you can do localized ones. But if something is endangered in a localized area, it would not be recorded as endangered. It has to be around the world, because most of these localized areas are arbitrary for humans. Because, yeah, if it was endangered in Wales, but not in England, that doesn't really mean much for the animals. So they have some stated goals, which is to provide scientifically based information on the status of species at a global level, like I said, to draw attention to the magnitude and importance of threatened biodiversity, which, yeah, is a really important goal. This is where it starts getting interesting, because it's to influence national and international policy and decision making. So they are actually trying to lobby governments to try and make them change their minds and, yeah, alter biodiversity conservation in the future. And to provide information to guide actions to conserve biological diversity. So it's not just to assess, but also to help understand how perhaps we can preserve it. But just a few little lists here. So there are more than 134,000 species on the IUCN Red List, and they're hoping to get that up to 160,000 pretty soon. Currently, there are 37,400 species threatened with extinction. This includes 63% of cycads, a type of plant. 41% of amphibians, quite tragic, 34% of conifers, 33% of reef-building corals, 26% of mammals, and 14% of birds. So the categories are probably things that you will have heard of. So we'll start at the most bleak, that is extinct. So this is beyond reasonable doubt that species no longer exists. There's extinct in the wild, you might have heard this said. So what this only survives in captivity or in cultivation or outside of its native range. Perhaps it's been reintroduced somewhere else. Critically endangered is another big one. This is in a particularly extremely critical state. Endangered, very high risk of extinction in the wild. Vulnerable, which, yeah, is not quite in danger, but it's vulnerable to that. Near threatened, and it's close to being at higher risk, or least concern, where unlikely to become extinct in the near future. There are two others which are data deficient and not evaluated, which are pretty self-explanatory. But it's important to note that data deficient and not evaluated does not mean that it's okay. Just because it's not listed as threatened does not mean that it isn't. Anything from critically endangered to vulnerable counts as threatened. You often hear threatened used in the media. But to give you an idea of how important it is, here's a quote from someone I think we all love. The IUCN Red List tells us where we ought to be concerned and where the urgent needs are to do something to prevent the despoliation of this world. It is a great agenda for the work of conservationists. And that was Sir David Attenborough. So there, a short history of the IUCN red list there. But admittedly, it's a list rather than really red. But Nick, I believe you want to talk about a redness that particularly plagues me.
Yes, and it's not blushing. When we started with red, I thought to myself, okay, red animals, red bam. And then obviously my brain went directly to sunburn. My question then was, are humans with fair skin the only animals that sunburn regularly? Because I thought it's sort of strange that we live in environments where we aren't naturally protected from the sun. So, these are the questions I asked myself when preparing for an episode of The Natural Selection. Loosely red, but we'll dive into it. Let's start with mammals. Sunburn is mostly a problem when the sun is shining directly on skin. So for most mammals, it's not a problem. They've got a layer of fur between the sun and their skin that protects them, which leaves us to deal with the furless mammals. Humans manage with sunscreen and varying amounts of melanin, which protects against sun damage. Domestic pigs have been bred by humans to have less fur than normal. So they're one of the few animals that has to deal with sunburn on a regular basis in the sort of outdoors. Pig farmers have to take care not to bake their pigs before they're ready. Naked mole rats are subterranean. Then that leaves us with just a few other furless mammals. Can you guys think of any that are left? We've dealt with humans, pigs, naked mole rats, you know, the heavy hitters.
Whales.
Any others? Big guys, too.
What about elephants?
Elephants have some hair, but they're furless.
Hippopotamus.
Thank you. Those are the three main categories. And they all deal with sun exposure in different ways. So elephants and rhinos have very thick skin, and they also have behavioral adaptations. They've got a penchant for mud and dust baths that help keep not only themselves sort of mite and parasite free, but it also helps protect them from the intensity of the sun. Hippos, and here's a bonus little red tidbit here, secrete a red fluid that's sort of like sweat, except that it looks just like blood, that according to a 2004 study, protects them from UV rays. Now the cetaceans, and this sort of was the most interesting of the subcategories for me, but the whales, dolphins, and porpoises do actually deal with sunburn. Some of them produce pigments that darken and protect their skins, think orca whales, for example, but others have genes that trigger a protective stress response and are super effective at repairing sun-caused skin damage. So some whales have even developed a hard keratinized layer that protects the skin beneath it from sun damage. All in all, it seems like these cetacean adaptations and all the others that we've talked about are pretty effective. But particularly the cetaceans, researchers on the subject haven't found any evidence of skin cancer in whales, despite the fact that they get sunburned, which I think is a pretty cool, like, something is going on in the cells that we don't do so well. Now, to wrap up quickly, I don't want to get all only mammal on you, so let's talk about some other vertebrates. Actually, interestingly, mammals are unique among the vertebrates in not being able to produce ultraviolet protective compounds in the cell. They can only do it by having dark pigment that helps absorb the sun's energy. But many other vertebrates have, and many other forms of life, have what's called gadusols. They're compounds that are sort of protective against ultraviolet that exist in the cell. They exist in bacteria, fungi, algae, and marine invertebrates, and they've also been found in marine fish, like the zebrafish. And it turns out that these fish can actually have them three different ways. They can either eat them in things like bacteria and algae, and then it stores them in their own cells. They can have symbiosis with these unicellular organisms, or they can synthesize it themselves. And it turns out, in a recent study from last year, that this de novo synthesis of these ultraviolet protective compounds, the genetic pathways for that synthesis exist in amphibians, reptiles, and birds as well, but not in mammals. And it may be because the earliest mammals were nocturnal and didn't need this sort of adaptation. So we've lost out on that sort of internal protection from the sun. But we figured out other ways of doing it. So sunscreen, first of all, SPF 50+.
That's really cool. What I really liked about this episode is when given the color red, we all sort of went abstract for the first half. But For the next half, we all picked amazing red animals. And I thought I'd start with my... I think I have a thing for animals that look like they might have been built by Tim Burton. This is another one. This is the maned wolf. So this is one of the most beautiful animals you will ever see. It's got like the most gorgeous red coat. It looks like, yeah, Tim Burton tried to build a fox. And they are from South America. They have a huge range. And they've got these really long, slender black legs, like really, really, really long. And this beautiful sort of russet coat. So a few things about it. It's not a wolf, despite being called a wolf. It's not a fox either. It's actually in its own genus. It's the only species in that genus as well. But its closest relative is the bush dogs. But they have quite an interesting diet. They're omnivores, similar to most dogs. They hunt. They catch birds in flight, which is pretty cool. About 21% of their hunts are successful. But they also scavenge as well. So they have done fecal analysis, and they found animals such as giant anteater, bush dogs, a collared peccary. But they don't know whether these animals were scavenged or hunted. They just know that they were eaten. There's also a fruit called the wolf apple, Solanum lycoparum, which is a tomato-like fruit, and this is the maned wolf's most common food items. And this makes up to 40 to 90% of the diet. And it's actively sought out by the maned wolf and consumed throughout the year. And this is quite useful for the wolf because most fruits are seasonal, but this one is not. So yeah, it's really, really useful part of its diet. One really interesting thing I found is it participates in a symbiotic relationship. So the maned wolf eats these plants, the wolf apple, and these fruits are useful because they're a way to disseminate seeds. And often the wolf will excrete on the nest of leafcutter ants. And these leafcutter ants will use the fertilizer to fertilize the fungus in their gardens. But they will sort and discard the seeds into the dung onto refuse piles just outside their nests. This process significantly increases the germination rates of the seeds. So you've got wolves, trees and ants and fungus working together there, which I really, really like. You've sort of got everything going on. It's quite a lot of fun. My main fascination by it is the long legs. It's so distinctive when you see it. And I was looking into why they have long legs. And the answer given is so they can sort of look over long grass and it helps them see. But that was sort of an odd reason for me, because there's not that much of a reason that this animal has to see over long grass more than any others. Like if it's hunting birds or small mammals, why would looking over long grass help if they're in the long grass or above it? Are you guys familiar with this wolf?
They look so cool. They're such cool looking creatures. Though it's the kind of thing that, like a moose, I feel like if I saw it in real life, I would be shocked at like something about it, either how tall or how not tall it is. I don't know. Haven't seen one, so. But those long legs, Nick, it seems like that's an adaptation in many animals that are built to run. You said that they have quite a wide range, and it may be that each animal covers quite a wide area. And having those long legs can usually help those animals run a bit more efficiently and save energy when they're running. So maybe that might be one reason for that.
But Naomi, from an animal that none of us have seen, you wanted to talk about an animal that I saw this week, which I can guarantee that you didn't.
Exactly. And that's kind of why I wanted to talk about it. So I wanted to talk about the red squirrel. And for you guys and for listeners who are living in Europe or who are from Europe, it is native to Europe. So its origins seem to appear in the Pleistocene, but they're pretty small and their bones are quite fragile, so finding them is quite rare. Some of the dates come from maybe 120,000 years ago to maybe 780,000 years ago, and found in like Hungary and places in Europe. The oldest ones that are definitely found from Britain are from 4,500 years ago, but people are pretty confident that they would have been in the UK about 10,000 years ago. So the red squirrels, I want to talk about them because they are red. And so before I get into it, I will say a bit of a caveat. And actually, Nick very helpfully brought up the IUCN red list, but they are of least concern. So they're doing quite well across Europe, the red squirrels. But in the UK and Ireland, they're not doing that well. Their populations have seen huge declines over the last 100 years or so. And there's a couple of different reasons for it. So I wanted to kind of talk about some of the reasons for why this is. But they're very cute looking. They're a rodent. They're called Scorus vulgaris. Quite as I mentioned, they were very abundant in Britain. And then they have gone into decline. So they actually had been hunted quite a lot in the 19th century. There's records. There were squirrel clubs that shoot squirrels. There was thousands of squirrels shot in seasons. And their populations have declined a lot. But there's a few kind of big ideas as to why they are declining. And the main reason is the introduction of the gray squirrel. So the gray squirrel is a native squirrel of North America. So it's native to the eastern part of North America. And it got introduced to the UK and also to Ireland and some other parts of Europe, but not it's not widespread across Europe, I don't believe.
They're not, but as I understand, their range is growing and the red one is shrinking, and there is concern about that.
Yes, yeah. So in the UK and Ireland, it does seem to coincide quite strongly where these grey squirrels have come in that the red squirrels do worse. So there's a couple of ideas. One is that the grey squirrel outcompetes the red squirrel. So there has been a study that was done in the 90s that was looking at the squirrels and their ability to consume food in a deciduous forest. So the study found that grey squirrels were better at getting nutrients from acorns than red squirrels were. And red squirrels actually do quite badly in an all acorn diet. Acorns are actually can be quite toxic, and red squirrels don't really do that well when they have to eat only acorns. So this may be that in these kind of areas that gray squirrels can do better. One is that maybe gray squirrels are just better at reproducing, that their numbers can just grow faster, that they can produce more squirrels than the red squirrels and therefore outcompete that way too. But some of these theories don't 100% make sense in all areas, because quite a few places it does seem to match that the gray squirrels have gotten introduced and then the red squirrels decline. But in some places the red squirrels declined before the gray squirrels got introduced, and then also in other areas they've cohabited for some time and it's been fine. So another idea, which is kind of what I was told when I was learning this in university, was that the gray squirrels carry squirrel pox. And the gray squirrels can carry it and it doesn't really affect them that much, but it can be quite fatal for the red squirrels. And it is quite horrible. The pictures of infected red squirrels is not very pleasant. So I do warn you, if you do Google it, it can eventually kill them. So this is kind of seems to be... Yeah, Nick is just, I think he's just Googled it. He's not looking happy. So if you want to cleanse your palate, look up a red squirrel kitten. Very. So squirrel pox seems to be something that is affecting red squirrels a lot more than gray squirrels, and they seem to be bringing it around. But there are some things that are improving the situation. One is that pine martens, their populations have been improving in some areas. And the pine martens selectively go for gray squirrels and not red squirrels. So this could be good. It's kind of a fledgling project and it couldn't necessarily work in all areas, but it can be used in some areas. And the populations are doing kind of okay in some parts of Scotland and in the west of Ireland, but it's definitely something that kind of needs to be monitored, and people are making efforts to try and help these red squirrels. And one of the things was trying to kind of eradicate the gray squirrel. And there's some pros and cons to kind of this method, and some methods don't necessarily work, but those are some of the ideas as to why the red squirrel isn't doing so great in the UK and Ireland. And unfortunately, maybe as Nick was mentioning with the gray squirrel getting into other parts of Europe, maybe that might cause some issues for its populations there. But hopefully people can kind of keep monitoring this. And also habitat loss is huge, is a huge issue as well. So unfortunately, I think they're dealing with a lot of problems all at once. These very cute red squirrels.
Not to be outdone, Nick picked perhaps the cutest animal in this show to finish on. So personally to me, I find this the most adorable. Nick, do you want to tell them what you picked?
Yeah. Oh, don't I? So, well, let me lead in first. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about structural color versus pigmented-based color and found that blue is a pretty tricky color to make as pigment in the natural world. On the other hand, red seems to be relatively easy to make. Not to, you know, disregard any of the cool creatures we've talked about today, but some animals and many plants make more intense reds than others. I would say the red squirrel is a pretty intense red. The Maine wolf, it's mixed in there, but it's got some red patches, rufous patches. This insect, though, that I want to talk about is it's actually white. So bear with me. Shout out to Nick for the insect. This is in the order Hemiptera, so it's truly a bug. And it's in the same suborder as aphids and whiteflies. It's called a scale insect, and the species is Dactylopius caucus. It's a parasite of the prickly pear cactus of Puncha. Do you guys have prickly pear? Have you ever seen a prickly pear cactus? Do you know what I'm talking about when I say that thing? Because I think it doesn't grow in Western Europe, but it definitely grows in Italy and around the Mediterranean. So maybe you've seen it around there. But it grows in Arizona, too, and all the way south through Peru, through Central and South America. This species of insect is native to southwestern United States and Mexico, and they live pretty much anywhere there are prickly pear. The females, and this is to quote some of the research that I was looking at, so sorry in advance for the horrifying quote, but I thought I should give you this language that's talking about this insect. The females penetrate the cactus with their beak-like mouthparts and feed on its juices. Horrifying, I know. But while doing this, they also coat themselves in a waxy secretion that protects them from drying out in the sun. That's white. So this is where they get their sort of scale insect name. It looks sort of like flaky scales on the surface of the cactus pad. But why bring this up in an episode on red? These are white species. So they have another way of protecting themselves, not against the sun this time, but against other insect predators. They produce and store in their bodies carminic acid, which when the insect is dead and dried, and then if you happen to grind it with a millstone and mix it with salts, you can produce what's called carmine dye, which is a super vibrant red that's been used in the Americas since the 2nd century BCE to dye things like clothing. The insect is also known as a cochineal insect, which you may be more familiar with the name as a dye insect. It can also be mixed with many other things. Acids and bases turn it different colors, like orange and yellow. And if you add a little bit of iron, the whole thing turns purple. So it's a really nice base for a lot of really vibrant colors for cloth. You can dye pretty much anything that will take color, wool, cotton, silk. And in particular, I think soap takes it up pretty well. It's sort of fallen out of favor, though, as a clothing dye, although today it's having a little bit of a resurgence in popularity as natural dyes are coming back into fashion in sort of a niche way, but not on an industrial scale. It is being used industrially, though. And do you guys know what it might be used for? Where might we find these little crushed up insects and their little acids inside of them today?
Food?
That's one of the two things. Exactly. It's used in food coloring. If you think of like red M&M, for example.
Yeah, we have red Smarties.
Yeah, red Smartie, too. It's the coach. Yeah. And there's one other, not a food, but there's one other thing where you might find this very vibrant red color.
Lippy.
Exactly. So you've got bugs in your M&Ms and your Smarties and bugs in your lipstick. So anyway, the next time you're headed out for a night on the town or having a night in with some snacks, remember to thank your friendly neighborhood parasitic scale bug.
I definitely will. the next time I see someone wearing vibrant red lipstick, if anything, I'll want to kiss them more.
Yeah. You might bring that out next time, Nick. Instead of a dragonfly fact, bring out your cool lipstick facts.
Did you know you've actually got crushed up bugs spread over your lips? I'm single. Well, on that note, that does bring us to an end of our episode on red. But please do join us again next week, where we'll be back with a new theme, which will be grasslands. So I hope you don't find that too plain. But until next week, from everyone here at the Natural Selection Presents, goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Naomi, what are these faces?
Sorry, I'm just I tried to open a satsuma and it's way too juicy, so I just got satsuma juice everywhere. Just, I'll be 1 second.
Side note, satsuma's my favorite fruit.